From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On this week's show, why some farmers want to add a right to farm amendment to the state constitution.
It could be essentially meaningless. That is, it'd be more a symbolic gesture.
Plus, a local woman lets go of her belongings by photographing the people who buy them.
And when I got out of my car and started to walk up to the house, several people came up to me and said, "Oh my gosh, we thought you had died."
And the fiddle player for the Wilders goes solo.
There's that fear factor of doing things that I'm not quite sure if it's going to work out, but it's kind of important to me on an ongoing basis to put myself in a place where I'm not quite sure.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. Individual state constitutions across the nation spell out a host of guaranteed rights for their citizens. For example, same-sex marriage or collective bargaining. But what about the right to farm? Harvest Public Media's Bill Wheelhouse reports on what's behind a new drive to establish that guarantee in Missouri and in other states.
Some farmers are feeling a bit defensive or put upon these days. Take the recent experiences of Bob Young, for instance. The 69-year-old raises 3,600 hogs on the land where he grew up near Rochester in central Illinois. When he was getting ready to build the hog confinement facility 6 years ago, some area residents concerned about the potential smell of the place filed suit. A court order stopped construction for 18 months.
A couple years there, our house was in foreclosure about every month. I just couldn't make house payment and keep up with everything else.
While that lawsuit ultimately fizzled, skirmishes like this are coming up with regularity across the country. And that's got agribusiness groups moving from defense to offense. The latest tactic involves passing constitutional amendments in individual states that would secure a right to farm.
We've noticed an uptick in attacks on agriculture, both culturally and politically.
Dan Kleinsorge leads an organization called Missouri Farmers Care. It's a mix of 40 groups, including the Farm Bureau and Monsanto. They've successfully lobbied to get state lawmakers in Missouri to put an amendment on the ballot in 2014.
The highest law in the state is the state constitution, so what we are really looking for is a right in that state constitution to protect farming.
Kleinsorge says it's about more than lawsuits. He points to, quote, attacks by animal welfare groups such as the Humane Society of the United States to put more regulations on livestock farming. Also of concern, opponents of genetically modified foods are making inroads with state laws and state ballot initiatives that would require the labeling of food.
You know, I want people to understand that this is something where agriculture kind of feels like it's been targeted by certain special interest groups to have a great deal of money.
Right to farm might seem like a strange notion. After all, we don't see banks or big box stores getting such protections. And there are already laws on the books in all 50 states to protect farmers from nuisance lawsuits. Farm groups, however, say most people are now at least two generations removed from farm life. And they don't always realize food production has changed or that the farming way of life they knew even a short time ago is dramatically different. They say that makes the public more willing to regulate farming. But the Humane Society sees it another way.
There's this trend because industrialized ag, oftentimes supported by the Farm Bureau, is really pushing to be able to not have to have any restrictions, environmental restrictions or any restrictions on how animals are raised or how farmers are treated.
That's Joe Maxwell, a vice president with the Humane Society. Maxwell, a farmer himself and former Missouri lieutenant governor, says constitutional protection would allow farmers to escape regulation.
They want to just be able to freewheel out there and do whatever they want and abuse whatever they want.
North Dakota voters approved the first right to farm constitutional amendment in the nation last fall. And right behind the ballot initiative in Missouri, Indiana, and Iowa look to be the next in line. The amendments differ a bit in their wording, but the general thrust is that the right to engage in farming practices shall not be infringed. University of Missouri political scientist Peveril Squire is an expert on state constitutions. He says there is still a question of what that means.
It could be essentially meaningless. That is, it'd be more a symbolic gesture than a sort of binding constitutional principle. There's nothing in this relatively few words that would give much guidance to legal authorities as they try to sort out all of this.
In Illinois, there is currently no drive for a right-to-farm amendment to the state constitution. However, back on his farm, Bob Young says he could support the idea, although Young suggests that maybe people shouldn't be so quick to move out of town into the idyllic countryside.
As far as city people moving out, most of them are fine. But there are a few that they come out here and think we got to change everything so we can make it city living, and that won't work.
In North Dakota, the amendment easily passed and little money was spent on the campaign. The battle in Missouri may be more expensive. The last time farm groups and the Humane Society squared off in that state, they had a combined war chest of $10 million. Bill Wheelhouse, Harvest Public Media.
The U.S. health system is undergoing a major technological shift right now. According to some people, it's finally catching up to where the banking and airline industries have been for years. It's no small change either. Think about it, moving all those doctor's notes into the digital realm. And at the heart of it all happens to be a company located right here in Kansas City. As KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, Cerner is more than 30 years old now and has become one of the nation's biggest players in health technology.
This is a story about data. Lots and lots of data.
I need to get you checked in at security here.
And not just any data, extremely sensitive data. Brian Smith oversees this place that he and many others at Cerner commonly refer to as the bunker. It's one of the data centers that Cerner, based north of the river, has built in the region in recent years as it's gone beyond being just a basic medical record company.
Flash your badge up there.
Once I get clearance from an armed guard, Smith leads me to an entrance that's more like a small, clear tube.
Stand in the middle without moving.
And the portal. Portal. This is that echo. The surrounding tube spins around and opens on the other side.
It's kind of James Bond stuff.
This data center, about 5 years old now, is responsible for the health information contained in hundreds of hospital systems throughout the U.S. In other words, this could be your data. That prescription your doctor just entered into his or her computer, that lab result that just got processed. Smith says Cerner takes that very seriously.
We have built a tornado-resistant bunker, so we can withstand up to an F5 tornado, 250-mile-an-hour wind speeds.
In fact, the records of the Moore, Oklahoma patients who had to be evacuated from a hospital recently didn't lose any of their health information because of Cerner's software. Those are just some of the tens of millions of healthcare transactions that are processed through this place daily. It sounds like this.
This is the sound of the technology that supports healthcare across the United States.
Smith and I are in a temperature-controlled room full of thousands of servers. The converted data in here is roughly equal to more than half a billion filing cabinets full of those manila medical folders. But Cerner's not just about housing data. 45,000 doctors use the company's record systems, and about 2,500 hospitals do too. The company has other IT services like sending out actual Cerner people to hospitals to run the systems. Between all these services, Cerner now employs about 12,000 people, with 8,000 based right here in Kansas City. Mike Nill is chief operating officer.
In fact, someone asked me last week, they said, what strategies did Cerner execute to survive the recession? You know, my answer was, you know, what recession?
In the last 2 years alone, Cerner has hired 3,000 people. Nill says they can't fill the engineer positions fast enough. The public company, headquartered in North Kansas City, is preparing to fully open a new campus in KCK this summer. Founder and CEO Neil Patterson recently highlighted the company's successes to a packed auditorium during its annual shareholders meeting. Patterson says Cerner all started out of a small informal meeting amongst friends, hanging out back in 1979. They were studying accounting outside at Luce Park.
We probably did more daydreaming about starting a company than we did studying for the exam. So it's through that interaction, Luce Park's a beautiful place to have envisioned this.
Today, Cerner has a market value of over $17 billion. That's based on last Thursday's stock prices. So how is it that Cerner's grown so much? Chaz Rhodes is a hospital consultant with the advisory board and says a major driver in all of this has been the federal government's infusion of cash into the healthcare industry in the last few years. It's made over $20 billion available to support health providers in digitizing their records.
It was a little bit like when the railroads were started in the late 19th and early 20th century. It's sort of public funding that has jump-started a big, big wave of investment in these IT systems among hospitals and doctors. So every hospital system that you talk to now is spending a lot of money or has just finished spending a lot of money to put in place electronic health records, to digitize all of the data about our health and the treatment that we're getting and so forth. And it's really expensive.
It has been a gold rush for companies like Cerner. Rhodes says it's not uncommon for him to hear that a hospital is spending a third of its capital on information technology. The U.S. government's found most hospitals now have some sort of electronic medical record system, compared to just 1 in 10 5 years ago. Figuring out which data system to use has put a lot of pressure on providers. Cerner is one of the major players, but there are many vendors to choose from. Dr. Greg Ader is Chief Information Officer at the University of Kansas Hospital. He says a big challenge is not just making sure the systems work well, but making sure all the doctors, nurses, and others who will use it like it.
Just imagine going out and buying a very expensive product for someone and saying, I selected this for you. What do you think? Like clothes, for instance. You know that? I mean, my wife does buy stuff for me, but, you know, I mean, it only goes so far. And I can reject things. We really can't reject multi-million dollar products.
Ader says deciding on a system is like entering into a marriage with no divorce option. It's really hard to switch systems once you've picked one. Back in 2005, KU Hospital began an extensive selection process, weighing in the feedback from all its doctors, nurses, and other health workers. It came down to two companies, Cerner and its main competitor, Epic. It's a private company based in Wisconsin. The hospital went with Epic.
But if you look at the past success of Epic and Cerner, Epic has been very successful in the academic world and has excelled in the what they call the whale operations, which are large academic medical centers.
Cerner's chief operating officer, Mike Nill, says he was disappointed with KU's choice.
Yeah, we do have one major competitor out there, and you don't want that competitor in your city. So by losing that opportunity, it forces us to look at why. And as we look at why, Cerner's very good at then making the adjustments, you know, to make us better and ensure that we don't lose in the future.
At the start of this radio piece, I said this was a story about data, but that data is just the beginning of a much bigger story. Electronic health data in and of itself is no silver bullet to making healthcare better. These digital record systems can still be a huge headache for doctors. But Cerner's CEO, Neil Patterson, and others throughout the healthcare industry say the key now is trying to figure out what to do with that data, how to measure it, how to analyze it, how to share it and use it so that doctors and patients can make the best healthcare decisions possible.
That's where the cost savings are going to come from, is keep you out of the hospital, keep you out of the emergency, keep you out of the ICU, and keep you away from the specialists, but make you healthier.
Achieving those outcomes is the challenge that Cerner and all these other companies are now racing to figure out. And it means that Cerner will certainly have plenty to do in the years ahead. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
And that was Alana's final story at KCUR, at least for now. She's moving this weekend to Philadelphia to be part of a health reporting team at WHYY, the public radio station there.
We'll miss Alana's reporting here on Casey Currents. Over the past few years, she's taken us into the examining room with patients.
That's no good. 172 over 85. Way too much. No.
How you feeling with that? Do you got a headache?
Duarte's getting her blood pressure checked.
She's also examined the local impact of our country's shifting health policy on free clinics, state Medicaid programs, and insurance. Alana reported on the irony of a McDonald's presence in a local hospital. It's since closed. And she took us along with an artist who gives rides to homeless people.
How are you doing?
Oh, hello, Woo. I'm glad to see you.
Yeah, I saw you walking. Are you okay?
Wu slows down next to a guy walking with a crutch on 47th Street.
Okay. I can take you there real quick. Come on, okay. Get in.
And just recently, Alana uncovered the story of Midtown Superman.
We have run a total of 2 blocks.
Yes.
And in those 2 blocks, you've gotten fist pumps, and you've gotten really weird looks, and you've gotten high fives. Is this typical?
Oh, yeah.
All right, is everybody ready to dancing?
Occasionally, Alana broke out of the health beat and revealed her obsession with tubas and accordions.
Okay, polka time!
And with that, the dance area fills with people, young and old, bouncing to the polkas and other tunes they've come to rely on and expect from the local accordion legend and his band. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
You can still catch Alana Gordon's unique take on health policy or just say goodbye on Twitter at @Alana_Gordon.
Alana, we'll miss you very much. Coming up next, photographer Gloria Baker Feinstein talks about her estate sale series. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. When Gloria Baker Feinstein moved out of her house into a much smaller condo because of her husband's health issues, she had an estate sale to get rid of a lot of the stuff that didn't fit into her new home.
It's not stuff, you know? Everything had a reason. Everything had a memory. Everything felt really dear to me.
Feinstein is a professional photographer, so she thought she'd make a record of her belongings before they went off into the hands of strangers. That idea changed as soon as she got started, as you'll hear in a minute. These photos are now part of a retrospective exhibit of her work called Can You See Me Now? At the Bohemian Gallery in Overland Park. Sylvia caught up with Gloria Baker Feinstein there to hear more about her estate sale series.
For me as a photographer, it's always been sort of a life-saving source for me, my camera, because I can use my camera to more fully understand things that I may not be able to understand otherwise. But it also lets me preserve memories. And so if I had a picture of a snow globe that reminded me of a trip that we took with the kids years ago, I felt like then maybe I wasn't truly parting with it. So if I had a photograph of it, it would make it easier. And I figured that would be how I'd work my way through the 3 days of the estate sale. So the first person who came out was holding 2 Kentucky snow globes, and I started to photograph the snow globes up against a backdrop that I had strung from the trees in our front yard. And I took some pictures of the snow globes, and then I pulled back a bit, and I realized that the woman who was holding the snow globes was so fantastic and so colorful and so lovely that it would be wrong of me not to take a picture of her. So I made the picture of her holding the snow globes, and then I knew right then that that was what I would be doing for the next 3 days, was photographing the individuals with their objects as they left the house.
And as a photographer, I know you must take photos of people often that you don't know. So I wonder what it's like to just ask somebody, by the way, could I take your photo with this object?
Yeah, it was funny because the second or third person said to me, oh, this is like being on Antique Roadshow. This is really fun. I don't watch Antique Roadshow, but I've referenced it since, and I know what they're talking about now. And it really was sort of celebratory. It made the sale more fun for them. It definitely made it easier for me and much more palatable. But what happened is they 90% of the people said, yes, you can take my picture. And what happened is that they began to tell me why they were drawn to that particular item and what they might do with it. And I was able to give them a little history of the item. So there was a dialogue that occurred that probably wouldn't have happened otherwise. And I think it made it more meaningful for them. And it obviously clearly made it a lot more meaningful for me to know where things were going and who they'd end up with.
I wonder if you remember what attracted her to a snow globe.
She actually told me. Her daughter-in-law is from Kentucky. I grew up in Kentucky, so I have a real connection to Kentucky, but that's what drew her to them. She was going to give them as a gift to her daughter-in-law.
Sounds like almost everything was meaningful to you. I mean, some people want to sell things just because they feel like they don't need them anymore, and they're kind of white elephants, but I wonder if it was hard to see why they would be meaningful to somebody who would want to buy them.
It was terrific to see that they had meaning to other people. For example, I sold a saddle that my son used to use when he was 6-7 years old. And it went to a mom who was buying the saddle for her son. And for her to be able to tell me how excited her son was going to be because she had found a saddle that would fit him, made it easier for me. It made me feel better. It made me feel like it was going to be repurposed and reused in a really positive way.
There's a picture of a little girl grinning, holding two copies of the Captain Underpants book.
Yeah, favorite books, clearly, back in the day. My daughter and son loved those books. And rather than just, you know, take them to Half Price Books or throw them in a heap somewhere, you know, it's just nice to know that that little girl is going to enjoy them now, too.
What about the guy who's holding the garden shears and also with a huge grin?
So the hedge clippers. Not, you know, it's not something that most people get emotionally attached to, and I certainly was never attached to those. I don't think I used them more than three or four times, but my husband did use them all the time to clean up our yard. So the hedge clippers represent a time in our life when we lived in a house, and my husband felt well enough to go out and trim the hedges. And it's representative of a piece of our past. And so while the hedge clippers themselves may have not meant so much to me, it was just the idea of the hedge clippers and what they stood for in our lives.
And he has this huge grin on his face.
He was so happy to find them. You know, they were probably $2 or $3. So, you know, he was excited and he immediately opened up the hedge clippers so that they framed his face and got a big kick out of the fact that he thought he was doing something really unique and wonderful. And that's the picture I took, which is really fun.
How many photos are there overall?
There are about 35 pictures just in the estate sale project. Showing in this show here at the Bohemian, there are 9 estate sale pictures. Probably my favorite is a picture of a man holding a broken doll bed. He looks rather gruff. He does not look like someone who would maybe be interested in a doll bed. But when I spoke with him afterwards, he told me that he's going to repair the broken doll bed and give it to his granddaughter, which was really wonderful for me because that bed was actually made for me. It was built for me when I was a very young girl, probably 4, 5, 6 years old, by the husband of the woman who used to care for me. And so it had a lot of emotion attached to it, a lot of meaning attached to it. I wasn't quite sure what to do with it. It's been sitting in our basement for years. It's been broken for years. Neither of my children wanted to take it. And again, I could have thrown it out and be done with it. But to know that this man was going to give it new life and make sure that someone else was able to enjoy it was, I don't know, it was just a nice ending for me. And it was really nice for him to hear the history behind it.
In some ways, these are portraits of you, and in some ways they're portraits of the people who bought the objects, and mm-hmm. Wonder what you see when you see them.
I think every photograph I make, in a way, Sylvia, is a portrait of me because I am injecting so much of myself into every decision that's made about how to make that picture. The estate sale pictures are even more so because of the items that are pictured along with the folks who posed for me. But the other piece of it is that it represents not just me, but it represents my parents and my grandparents and on to my children and my grandchildren. When I arrived at the sale there at 8 in the morning on the first day, there was a long, long line of people waiting to get into the sale. And when I got out of my car and started to walk up to the house, several people came up to me and said, "Oh my gosh, we thought you had died. It's so great to see you." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And they said, "Well, we saw the ad in the paper, estate sale of Gloria Baker Feinstein, fine art photographer. Hadn't seen you in, you know, a couple of years. I thought, oh my gosh, she died. It's so sad. We were shocked to see you get out of the car." So some of it is, you know, maybe it made me think about when my mom died and the things that we kind of had to sift through and what will we do with those and where will they go and what did they mean. And it made me think about the day that I will die and my kids sifting through my things and trying to decide, you know, what they're attached to and to pass on to their children. So in a sense, they're not just portraits of me, they're portraits of generations of my family.
Now, I came across a series in a photography blog in the New York Times website, and I wonder if there are other places where this series has appeared or other places that you've gotten attention for it.
No, the New York Times picked it up and ran with it, and then this is really the first time here at the Bohemian that the work's been shown.
Just to describe the photos for our listeners, they are against this backdrop that is kind of, at least it comes out kind of green, blue. The colors are really saturated, and I wonder what kind of camera you used and how you achieve that look.
The colors are very rich, very saturated, and I used a really big, heavy, expensive, complicated camera called my camera phone. I shot all of those with my iPhone. And I chose to do that because I didn't want to seem the least bit, you know, threatening or overbearing or even professional. I wanted it to just be a fun, easy activity. I had no idea I would eventually show the work.
What does that mean to you as a photographer? I'm sure you have maybe slightly fancier cameras than the iPhone.
I do. And whenever anyone asks me what is my favorite camera, I say whichever one I have on me. The technical aspect of photography is not really that interesting to me. What camera I'm using doesn't really make that much of a difference. I'm a firm believer that it's what's in my head and my heart, as cliche as that might sound, that makes the picture.
What year was it that you did the estate sale?
The estate sale was last year. It was about a year ago.
Okay. Yeah. The actual sale?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was pretty recent.
Yeah, I survived.
And have you moved?
We moved. Yeah, we moved. And the woman who ran the estate sale is 86 years old. She is this little dynamo. She's about 5 feet tall, if that. And she became kind of like a therapist during this whole process. And she was so wonderful to help me kind of get through it. And she came to the opening here at the gallery and was so excited to see these folks who she knows as her regulars, they come to a lot of her sales, to see them elevated to, you know, the status of a very clean white gallery wall and people walking around sipping wine and talking about, you know, the guy holding the hedge clippers. So she got a huge kick out of it and went home and called a few of them and told them they were in the show, and a couple of them have come in to see the show and have really enjoyed it.
Gloria, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It was fun.
Some of Gloria Baker Feinstein's estate sale photos are part of her retrospective exhibit called Can You See Me Now? Open until Saturday at the Bohemian Gallery in Overland Park. You can also see some of the photos she talks about on our website at kcur.org. Thank you.
And speaking of artists in KC, we've been inspired by the Mexican art exhibit this summer at the Nelson Atkins Museum, particularly the tumultuous and creative partnership between Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. So here on KC Currents, we've decided to explore some other creative partnerships here in Kansas City. We'd like to hear some suggestions of artist couples whom we can profile this summer. Just send an email to kccurrents@kcur.org or send us a message on Twitter at KC Currents.
There are several rugby teams in the KC area. Some are very popular, like the Kansas City Blues, a USA Rugby Division I club. There's also a team for women, like the Kansas City Jazz. But as KC Currents' Zach Lewandowski found out this spring, one team has a mission that goes beyond the rough-and-tumble game.
The KC Carnivores are not just a local rugby team. They are a non-profit organization that seeks to bring rugby to those underrepresented in the sport, with an emphasis on gay and bisexual players. And though the team is very accepting, don't let that fool you into thinking this team takes it easy.
Ready? Go, run. Out of my face. If you can talk, you're not running fast enough.
That's Bree Morales. She is the head coach of the Carnivores and has more than 15 years of rugby experience. Women aren't allowed by rule to play in official games, but they are invited to attend practices and scrimmages.
You mean run intervals? I'm overheating.
During this practice, Bree yells out instructions through the cold night air as temperatures drop to just above freezing.
Remember, don't throw yourselves on the ground. It should be a graceful move. Some of you, we need to work on this. That's why we're doing it. Alex, I don't advise you to do it on the concrete.
I'm not doing it on the concrete, don't worry.
The Carnivores are a close-knit team that enjoys each other's company. Laughter is as common as hits during a practice.
I think my face made friends with your elbow.
Yeah.
Head coach Morales says the team is like a family.
Like Yama over there, we know his ankle's hurt, and he knows to expect 15 calls from 15 different people tomorrow. And we all check on each other. If anybody says they're having a bad day, we all start calling around. We try to initiate family dinners and things like that, too. So when we're close off the field, we're close on the field.
It is their experiences off the field that make the Carnivores unique. The majority of the players on the team are gay, and it wasn't so easy for some growing up. Alex Medina serves as the vice president of the Carnivores and also plays the winger position.
The duty of the winger is to catch the ball, run like hell, and try not to get hit.
This seems like the perfect position for Medina, who admits he was never much of a sports guy before joining the Carnivores, but is a frequent marathon runner. For Medina, playing rugby is a chance to let loose and release some frustrations from the past.
I think it is a safe space for people. It also allows a little bit of the aggression out that we sort of get with the frustration of if you were bullied in school, then you can sort of get that out because some people were bullied. I mean, I was fortunate where I wasn't, but there's still that frustration that you get growing up gay in any sort of small town. I grew up in a small town of 1800, so you still feel the stress, and this is just a way to get that out there.
Medina and the Carnivores have found a safe haven in a sport that is pretty physical in nature. Rugby is not for the faint of heart. Seth Gaines is the president of the Carnivores. He was also once the victim of a hate crime. He was stabbed in the leg with a knife because he is gay, and the scars on his leg are there to remind him. With the Carnivores, the only pain he feels is a few seconds of aftermath from a rugby hit. Gaines believes playing rugby can help eliminate some of the stereotypes associated with gay men.
Well, I will say as someone who's pretty athletic, I'm an athlete, and I'll get out there and I'll tackle and I'll go after it. But off the pitch, I'll hey, girl, hey, with the best of them. But yeah, I think that's the beauty of rugby is that if you can get out here and you can play rugby without pads, because we don't wear pads, and you can deal with the pain, and you find yourself a home on this team, you realize that through diversity, through camaraderie, and through bonding together, you can really push through anything.
Kevin Keezer is a UMKC freshman. He says that it doesn't matter if you are gay or straight, or even if you have any rugby talent at all to join the Carnivores. Keezer was born in Japan before moving to Australia, where his love for rugby took off. He then eventually found a home in Kansas City. Keezer says that at first, he was the slowest person on the team, but that didn't matter because he says the KC Carnivores are all about making people feel comfortable.
We've never tried to put a label on anything, so the moment someone shows up, someone's there to shake your hand, someone there to ask you your name, ask you what you like, and then it's not a contest in that aspect. We love winning, but more than anything, we love having a place to feel accepted and have fun without any pressure of any sort of label.
Having fun for Keezer includes taking hits from the opposing team. Keezer is the team captain and takes on whatever role is necessary for his carnivores to win.
I'll play any position. I actually am not really worried about getting hit. I'll just, no matter what team I'm going towards, it's like, hey, which position do you least want to play? And I'll do that.
After games, the carnivores do events like game nights and potlucks. Keezer says the team is not the family he was born into, but the family he chose. And the carnivores themselves belong to a bigger family, as a member of the Heart of America Rugby Football Union, which spans out across Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. They play against several other Kansas City rugby clubs. Keezer says their reception from the other teams has been pretty positive, for the most part.
Majority of the teams that we play against are incredibly amazing, and they accept us, like, they just treat us like any other team. There are a couple teams that we've played against. Definitely not going to name any names, but we've felt like a couple times the F word was going to pop out. I mean, in those instances, you just try to play your best game and you just try to play to the spirit of the sport. But other than that, everyone's pretty awesome and pretty accepting about it.
Go!
All right, keep for it.
Look. Take it.
Good job.
The carnivores are also part of iGRAB, which stands for the International Gay Rugby Association and Board. iGRAB is an umbrella organization that encourages gays, lesbians, and bisexuals to play rugby. They also host the Bingham Cup, considered the largest non-professional international rugby tournament in the world. The event is held in Sydney, Australia in August of 2014, and the KC Carnivores plan on being one of the 40 teams in attendance. Alex Medina says iGRAB's existence sheds light on how diverse the gay community is.
There's no such thing as a gay person who does just one thing. We're all diverse. We all have our little crazy little quirks of practicing rugby at 45 degrees in temperature. A lot of gay people don't want to play rugby. That's their thing. A lot of people, gay people want to play rugby. The fact that iGRAB exists sort of indicates that there's not just one mold.
And the players take pride in the fact that they are just as different as everybody else. For KCUR, I'm Zach Lewandowski.
After the break, fiddle player Betsy Ellis talks about going solo. This is KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. South Central Missouri is gearing up for a signature festival that organizers say pays tribute to the Ozarks like no other. KSMU's Jennifer Davidson has this feature on the Old Time Music Ozark Heritage Festival taking place in downtown West Plains, Missouri, next weekend.
Much of the music that will permeate downtown West Plains on those 2 days will have been passed down from generation to generation, both in the selection of songs and the skill of playing the actual instruments. Kathleen Morrissey has helped organize this festival for 19 years. I ask her to define old-time music.
The clearest I can give you about old-time is the music that came with the actually, part of it came with European immigrants who came over and settled in this part of the United States, and then it evolved as their customs evolved. But it has its roots very deeply seated in the Scots-Irish tradition, and so you will hear things with the fiddle that happen, the fiddlers that are playing schottisches and jigs and things that you wouldn't ordinarily associate with the fiddle. It became the instrument of choice.
Almost every pioneer Ozarks family had a fiddle in the closet, she said, even those who wouldn't claim to be fiddle players.
Also, people who came to this region, they were of a very independent stock. And this carries over today. Many of them would rather make the music than go listen to the music. Old-time music bands are coming from Branson and Springfield, as well as from the tiny towns of Galena, Winona, and Ava. Those performances will run throughout both days of the festival. There's also a cooking stage, where presenters will teach you how to make everything from apple dumplings to buffalo chili to roast beaver and squirrel pot pie. Yes, really. I ask Morrissey how much of this is about heritage and how much is about poking fun at our own Ozarks culture.
People talk about a lazy hillbilly. There was no such thing as a lazy hillbilly, because if you were lazy, you couldn't survive. The immigrants who came through here and who chose to stay here, they had to be able to figure out ways to eke out a living. And the archaeologists will tell you that the immigration happened on the north side of this region and on the south side. All the big immigrant trails, the Natchez Trace, you know, the White Trace, they all happened outside of this region because the largest numbers of people couldn't get through this region. It was this big, this sort of this kind of this uninhabitable place.
And this festival, she says, is designed to honor those who did persevere, their music, their foods, their survival skills, and even their forms of entertainment. That includes the event that the festival has become most widely known for. The Mule Jump Contest will take place Saturday, June 15th at 3 o'clock. That tradition was derived from hunters on their mules who came to a fence they needed to cross. The rider would slide under the fence, and the mule, remarkably, could jump 5 feet from a standing position. To see the festival schedule, you can visit oldtimemusic.org. The festival is free and open to the public. For KSMU News, I'm Jennifer Davidson. Our next guest is carrying on those old-time Ozark music traditions in her own way. She's from Arkansas, actually. For 15 years, fiddler Betsy Ellis helped lead and shape the Wilders, an internationally known old-time country quartet that toured the U.S. and Europe. But in December of 2011, the Wilders announced they were going on an indefinite hiatus. Betsy Ellis, though, is still going strong. She stopped by KCUR this week to talk to Alex Smith about her solo career.
After the Wilders announced their hiatus, Betsy Ellis found herself at a crossroads. She'd been working as a professional musician for 12 years, but was now considering turning away from performing. After a lot of soul-searching, Ellis ultimately decided to return to the road, not with a band, but as a traveling solo performer.
I can play the whole evening, two sets of solo material, and you know, I travel around with two fiddles, and then I play my tenor guitar and sing with the fiddle as well, and between that and storytelling, a night goes by pretty quickly.
Twilight is stealing over the sea. Shadows are falling dark on the lee.
During the last year and a half, Betsy Ellis has spent a lot of time behind the wheel of her Chevy Malibu on the way to gigs and workshops around the Midwest and Rockies. Being a lone wolf frequently means taking chances. In addition to the solo shows, Ellis does a lot of jamming and playing with pickup groups, often playing with people she barely knows. But she says taking these kinds of musical risks keeps things interesting.
There's that fear factor, doing things that I'm not quite sure if it's going to work out, but it's kind of important to me on an ongoing basis to put myself in a place where I'm not quite sure. And that type of challenge is, maybe that's a little bit addicting, I think. So most of the time it works out great, you know, and that's the other thing about live music too. If it doesn't work out great, it's okay, it's just a moment, it's passed, it's gone.
So you're traveling again on the road, there's no end.
This summer, Betsy Ellis will spend 2 or 3 weeks a month on the road, and she'll be doing her first solo East Coast tour. She also hopes to return to touring in Europe soon. Ellis says that these days, the folk and old-time music of the American South and Ozarks has devotees almost everywhere. And for the most part, the music is no longer unique to the areas it came from. But as Betsy Ellis discovered while touring with the Wilders, her Arkansas heritage is still seen as a kind of pedigree to audiences she meets in Europe.
That's when I get to be exotic. Yeah, we when the Wilders were, when we'd go to Scotland, or we toured Germany too, and boy, they would just think that we were out, you know, riding horses every day and, you know, singing cowboy songs and all of that, and it's pretty fun.
In November of last year, between road tours, Betsy Ellis started recording a new solo CD entitled High Moon Order. Some tracks sound almost straight out of the 30s, while others are modern lo-fi country rock. From just the first few song titles, The Traveler, Golden Road, and Long Time to Get There, it's clear that traveling is never far from her mind, even in the studio. One song, The Collector, is about hearing the love stories of people she meets on the road and turning them into music. Ella says that this songwriting method was inspired by the founder and patriarch of the legendary Carter Family Band.
Gathered ideas of what it was. For some, it's a feeling.
That's what A.P. Carter did. He drove around the mountains there in Virginia and surrounding states just in his region and met with people and collected songs from them and then turned them into the songs that the Carter family recorded and so many people throughout this country and beyond just absolutely loved.
Collecting love stories like a musical scholar, Dobby McNeil or A.P. Carter, in the mountains and the plains, there's romance, there's pain. Some of us find
while Betsy Ellis grew up in Arkansas, she didn't start playing Ozark music until she was an adult. Ellis grew up listening to a lot of rock and punk bands, and parts of her new CD attempt to link these two different musical worlds. On one song, Ellis reimagines the Clash song Straight to Hell as something like a folk tune.
You can play on the fiddle. How's about a British jig and reel?
Clash and Talking Heads are two of the bands that I consider, I refer to that as my personal folk music. It's like the music that, during my developmental years, that I grew up with. But it was a few years ago, I felt compelled to attempt to learn a way to present that song, Straight to Hell, with just me and a fiddle. And now I've played it, I mean, just as many times, I've probably played Straight to Hell just as many times as some of the Ozark fiddle tunes that I've known for the last 15 years. I play it almost every performance.
Go straight to hell, boys! Go straight to hell, boys! You want to join in a chorus?
Ellis jumps into folk punk with both feet on the song The Complainer. She says that after writing the song, she realized how much the cathartic lyrics of 70s punk and Great Depression era music have in common.
Mike West, my producer, he maintains too that it's actually, subject-wise, it's very much like the songs of the 20s, just, you know, the Depression era string band songs. And so it's something to get out, you know, it was something to get out of me. And hopefully there's recovery after that, but it's probably the shocker track on the album, I'm guessing.
The rock songs are broken up with tracks of traditional music and tributes to old-time music legends, like this tribute to late fiddler Art Stamper. Ella says that paying tributes to her inspirations in both the old-time music and rock world motivate her to keep playing.
What I've learned from old-time music is that the reason it continues and the means that it continues is, in essence, in itself a tribute. And I feel really, really fortunate that I get to do that, both in a live way and a recorded way. And that is one of the things that keeps me going.
Betsy Ellis's new recording is called High Moon Order. Her CD release party is Friday, June 14th at The Brick. The Brick is also currently exhibiting a collection of Ellis's photos from her musical travels. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there and sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes.
Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Monica Sandretsky and Ryan Schisler. Theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.